the regular meeting to order. First thing we'll do is recess the supplemental meeting. And now what we'd like to do is have a moment of silence for all the officers, firemen, and first responders who have passed away since our last meeting. Thank you. Next, I'd like to go to the consent agenda. And the first thing would be the minutes from the last meeting, from the November 11th meeting. Does anyone have any comments, or can we get a motion to approve those?
Move approval.
Second?
Second.
All in favor? Any opposed? Carries. Then next we have the detailed consent agenda. Kelly, is there anything on that you'd want to flag?
It's actually a very light agenda. You'll see there was very little activity in a lot of areas, which is pretty unusual, but no unusual items.
Okay. All right. Can we have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next, we're going to go to public comment. Ms. Walters, we'd love to hear from you.
I'm Christy Walters. Good morning. My husband was a firefighter who died in line of duty serving this city, and I have been told that because of the House bill that took effect in 2017, that I will not get my husband's full pension. And I have three children, two are college, one is high school, and my half of the pension, I don't mind telling you, is not a lot of $1,800 a month. And I am being told I will have to support my family on $1,800 a month forever. So I just wanted to introduce myself and let y'all see we're real people. We are not numbers on a page. We are Christy, Ethan, Chris, and Sam Walters. And I'm hoping y'all will have time to discuss our issue at some point for survivors.
Well, Ms. Walters, first of all, just our we have such deep sympathy and condolences on your loss, and it's men like your husband that make this city work as a safe, functioning community. So we're sorry for your loss. Thank you for coming up and speaking your mind, and it's something that I told you that we will discuss this, and we will get back to you in due course. So thank you for coming and us getting to see who you are and all that. So
I'm going to go. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
If anybody that's called in wants to speak, that's 5-star. Raise your hand after I meet you.
Okay. No, nothing? Okay, great. Okay, let's go ahead and move on. Now we'll go to item C1. And we'll get a report from the audit committee from right from the North Pole.
So fresh out of the meeting, we went up there. I don't want to steal a lot of Jill's thunder, but we did meet with Jill and Matt here a few minutes ago. Basically the audit is complete. They've got everything they need except the approval of this body to approve and accept the audit, and then they'll issue the audit opinion. They got a clean opinion. There were no internal control issues whatsoever, not even any minor control. They have an evaluation expert who also looks at some of the Lone Stars and the Huffs and things like that, and verify that the methodology is consistent and we're conservative in our valuations there. We talked about, you know, this year was the first year they used offshore audit services from India, and that worked very well. It was transparent. Nobody had any issues or problems. It didn't cause delays. I mean, our audit gets delayed out a lot because of we're waiting on the private equity, so we're just finishing. This is the 2020 audit that we're talking about. So we're getting under the race to get before 21 ends. We have not, you know, everything went well. There, in your handout, I think you everybody's got the financial statements. I had suggested two minor modifications that will be made. One was on page 46, where we talk about subsequent events. We didn't mention that we are switching the pension plan from the DC plan to the TMRS plan effective January 1st. So we're going to add something in there. And then earlier on page 24-25, we show the target allocation, which is our long-term asset allocation. However, we're pretty far away from that, so we're going to add some wording and verbiage in there that explains that this is our long-term plan. However, we're not quite there, and we're going to transition there over a period of time as soon as we can liquidate some of these illiquid investments. But those are the two issues. And then the third issue, which is not financial statement related, is that it says that we, you know, on concentrated credit risk, we don't have a specific policy other than to be a diversified asset allocation. I would suggest that Ryan and Makita and Gilbert, you guys look at that. I mean, most funds I've been involved with have a specific thing that no issue would represent more than X percent of the fixed income portfolio. Usually it's 5% at cost or something along those lines. That's prudent to have something like that so we don't end up owning half our portfolio in Tesla bonds or something along those lines. So I would, if we can just include that in the minutes and ask them to do that. But other than that, it went very well, and we're proud that Jill and Matt and her whole team stayed together despite all the problems in the audit field where people are turning over 30% or more. We didn't lose anybody, and we stayed on track. So that is the report, unless Armando or Tina, do you want to add anything?
No, that's about it.
Nope. Any questions from anybody?
No, just a comment. Kudos to the staff for not having any internal control issues. That's really good.
Yeah.
So
thanks
to them.
Yeah, BDO did say the staff is very responsive when they needed to be so. Kudos.
So, Brenda, that's outsized to you. So it's so great job.
And if I could just add to that,
yeah.
I review the financials and the annual report every year, and I had far fewer comments this year than I have had in the past. So I would also like to congratulate Brenda, Lorenzo, Bill, Melissa, and John on that.
Thank you.
Jill?
All right. Here we go. So as Bill just said, we went through all this with them, so I'll hit the highlights here with you guys and won't read all of this to you. Here on this first page, it just reminds you what our professional standards require, and we are required to communicate with the audit committee, the board, what we consider those charged with governance, our significant judgments and things that are relevant to your responsibilities in governing the system. As Bill mentioned, we have completed our audit, which our objective is reasonable assurance, right, consistent with before, and our opinion is a clean opinion, unmodified opinions, the terminology we use at this point. And again, I know you've all said it, but I will say it again, management's cooperation was excellent. This definitely was a different year with everybody being remote, and for Brenda and her team to have maintained the system of internal control and to have a great set of clean financials was very good, and we really appreciate all the help they gave us along the way. The results of our audit
Accounting practices, policies, and estimates, these are consistent from the prior year. The if you look in note 2 to the financial statements and as well as 4 and 5, you'll see the more significant policies and accounting estimates. There is a new standard that will be effective for you after July 1, 2021, related to leases. This is consistent with what corporate entities are having to do as well, which has already been effective for them. But I'm not expecting a significant impact for the system from that, but that is a new standard that you will have to consider. And then, of course, our significant estimates are the actuarial valuation and the fair valuation of your investment. As I
Did I lose everybody?
This is Rob French. I can't hear any audio either.
Gene, can you hear us? Rob, I'm going to text somebody.
Okay, sounds good.
Rob, they said they're connecting again.
Should we be back in?
Who's on the telephone?
Okay, you have me, Gilbert Garcia. It had dropped.
Yeah, Michael, Rob French is here, too.
And Michael Brown's here, too.
Awesome. Team is back. Let's proceed.
Sounds good. So quality of financial reporting, again, absolutely no issues with the financial reporting. The draft of the report was in very good shape when we received it, and so no issues from there. The next couple slides go through the various areas, which we covered off during our planning conversation as well, the larger focuses for us, right? And internal controls are one. We're not auditing your internal controls, but we are going through them, gaining an understanding for our risk assessment, because if there were an issue, that would impact my risk assessment and the procedures that I would need to perform. So as we noted before, no issues related to internal control. The actuarial valuation is where we do use experts. We have in-house actuaries who review those reports. No issues there. Eligibility, benefits, payments, no problems, pretty straightforward, substantive procedures, no findings on the investments, no findings, but this is the heavy lift in the audit, right? So looking at all the securities, looking at valuations, existence, and we also involve our BDO internal valuation experts in the procedures that we do around your investments. Receivables, payables, expenses, investment income, no issues. fraud procedures. We do, not that there is specifically an identified fraud that has occurred or things like that. In an audit, we are required to presume that fraud would exist and identify where it potentially could exist. So we do procedures around that and had no issues there. Those procedures do include interviewing several of you, interviewing management and other people within the system, as well as varying the nature and scope of timing of our audit, and then performing detailed journal entry testing so that we can ensure journal entries, if there were anything in there, that we search for those. Commitments and contingencies and sub-events, Bill mentioned adding a sub-event to the disclosures, which we'll get that into the financials, but otherwise no issues in those areas. The next slide covers more about internal controls over financial reporting and the different categories. If you did have findings, again, there were no issues with internal control. These go through some additional required communications that are part of the standards. So, you guys can definitely read these. I think the most critical one in here is that we do use specialists to help us do this. And there were no disagreements with management as we worked through the audit. And then the management rep letter, we do have that already, so we are ready to issue as soon as you all are ready to approve. We'll be good to go. Any questions?
Don't have anything? All right, well, can we have a motion to approve the issuance of the 2020 audit report subject to final review and approval by BDO and the executive director? We have a motion.
I move that.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Brenda, did you want to do highlights of the financial results as well as?
I will.
Yeah, that's where we're going to go. Brenda now.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone. Let's see if we can get back to where we want to be here. I originally presented the 2020 financials in February, and as you can see, it's been a while, as Jill said, our challenge. We complete most of the work in April and May, and then it's hurry up and wait, and then get our actuary report, and the last 30 days has been hectic to get through the actuary report, the financials, and our ACFR that we'll see. I want to start by thanking Jill and Matt. We really appreciate all the hard work that they put into getting the audit of our financial statements complete. Again, we're not normal in that they don't start and finish in 30 or 40 or 60 days. It's a long period of time, and we appreciate them kind of hanging in there with us as we go through the process. So this morning I'm going to talk just a little bit about highlights of the audited financials. I gave you the original statements in February, but the actual audited financial report contains a lot more than just the financial statements. If you haven't seen that, I hope to introduce it to you, show you a resource of some interesting information that the accountant is going to say is interesting. And I'm going to start here on page 41 for those of you who are following along remotely. The first section of the financial reports is the management discussion and analysis, or MD&A. This is about 7 pages in total. If you don't have an opportunity to read anything else, I would really encourage you to read this small section. It is a high level of the activities of the plan over the last year. On page 41, you're going to find the combined statements of fiduciary net position. This presentation is a 3-year comparative presentation. And as we look at the results for 2020, we see that the net position decreased by $115 million in 2020 when compared to 2019, and that's primarily due to investment losses and benefit payments exceeding contribution payments. From the original February presentation, the net position has decreased by $53 million, and that's due to changes in the investment value. The next page, page 42, is the combining statement of changes in fiduciary net position. If we take a quick look at contributions, the 2020 city contributions increased by $6.5 million or 4.1% over 2019, and that's due to the increase in the floor that we're using every year. The member contributions increased by $5.2 million or 9.9%, and that was because of increased salaries of members. Down just a little bit further, you'll see the net income from investing activities. It decreased by $133 million in 2020, and that's driven primarily by the depreciation in the fair value of the private equity assets. We move on to page 47 and 48. This is the same combining statement of fiduciary net position. This presentation, though, actually separates out the combined plan from the supplemental plan. And it's one of the few times during the year that you actually will see the plan presented separately. So this is the fiduciary, the segments of fiduciary net position here, and then the next one is the changes. Again, same information that you saw earlier on, just split between the two plans. Just interesting in that you get to see them separately, and that doesn't happen. There's not a lot of opportunity for that. I'm going to go to page 49. This is the beginning of the notes. So in the audited financials, you have the financial section, then you have the notes section. The notes are a really important part of the audited financials. They provide important information about the financial statements themselves, as well as information about the overall financial status of the plan. Particularly, so there's about 11 notes here. I'm just going to mention note 3, which starts on page 59, investments. And I just want to show you a couple of pieces of information that you will see in the audited financials that, again, you may not see this presentation otherwise throughout the year. The first is this fair value comparison table. You'll see the 2020 versus 2019. On the next page, you'll see the fixed income maturity table. So this isn't something that we talk about. What are the maturities? You've got 2020. And then on the next page, 2019, so you've got a couple of years. And then if you go to the next page, you see foreign currency tables. Again, just interesting information about the financials that you may not see throughout the year. Just want to let you know that the audited financials are a resource, and here you can go and find this information. So the final part to the audited financials is a section called Required Supplementary Information, and that starts on page 83. For those following through diligent, let me see if I can get us there. So Required Supplementary Information has both combined and supplemental plan. The great part about this information, it's a lot of trending schedules. So here is the 7 years for both combined and supplemental plans, talking about information on, you know, the net position of the plans, the pension liabilities. So a lot of good trending information that you can see, as well as a lot of historical information that you find in this kind of final section of the required supplementary information. So I hope I've introduced you to maybe some things that you didn't see or know before. Know that this is a resource that you can go to. Are there any questions about the 2020 audited financials?
Okay.
So we're really talking about approving the issuance of this whole report, of which the audit is a large component,
yeah.
Right?
So the first section
yeah.
was just about the audited financials.
Yeah.
And then we'll go to that that one next, which the audited financials are just a part of that.
Okay. So that's what you're going to discuss now. Okay. Got
yes.
it. Okay.
Okay. So the next thing that we're going to look at is the report called the, well, you may recognize it as the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. Let's see if I can move on to get us there. Here we go. You may recognize it as previously being called the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. The title of this report is now, instead of Comprehensive Annual, it's Annual Comprehensive. CAFR is now called ACFR. Again, it was done to be more inclusive. The name change was effective starting in 2021. We have chosen to early adopt, and so you'll see that here. So I'm just going to run through a few highlights. Again, show you what a great resource this can be, where you can find information if you haven't looked at it before. This is posted on our website, and our prior year report dating back to 2014 are on the website, so you certainly can go there now. Once we have finalized this, it will be on the website as well. So for those who may not have seen it before or may have forgotten from last year, what the heck is an ACFR? This annual comprehensive financial report is a thorough, detailed presentation of the pension system's financial condition, and it reports on the pension's activities and balances through the year.
Right. Okay.
So I'm going to start here on page 106, which is just a table of contents to show there's five sections. Introduction, it's the financial information, investment information, the actuarial information, and statistical information. So in the first introduction section, starts with a transmittal letter. Again, high-level information about what has happened to the plan, funding, significant events over the last year. Also includes our awards. We're very proud to say that we received the GFOA award for our 2019 annual report, as well as an award from the Pension Council for Administration. We feel that our current report. I'm okay? Okay. We feel that our current annual report will meet the standards, and we expect to receive these awards for the report that you're looking at now. But very proud of these that we received for this last report. A page with all of your smiling faces here and information about the board. And then we have a section on the financial information. So the financial information section in this annual report is identical to the audited financials that we just went through. The formatting gets changed a little bit to match the other formatting that's here in the report, but it's identical word for word. So I'm not going to go through the financial information since we just did that, and I'm going to move on to the investment section. So bear with me a minute. For those of you, again, following at home, page 187. Here we go, investment information. So we start off the investment section with a letter a memo from Makita highlighting some information there. Again, what I want to point out in the investment section is there may be information that's presented here that you don't normally see throughout the year in a little different presentation. I like this this table here that is the investment table by asset class. It has benchmarks. It has time periods, the 1, 3, 5, and 10-year returns against the benchmark. So you see here, it's over two pages. I always think this is a great table and gives a lot of information about the investment.
Just one question on that.
Yes.
Back to like the 187, it showed the 1.7% return. I think it's important for the public to realize that that's a result of, you mentioned that a variety of times, you know, a market that was fairly robust. We're still trying to the sense of assets that are a drag on our returns.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. And Makita certainly does mention that in their letter here, the illiquid or the private assets that we're still working through on our asset allocation is certainly having an effect on that return that we see. Thank you. A couple of other items, overview and goals, you guys see that. We talk about that all the time. But there's information about investment management fees, whether how much is paid by the system, how much is paid through the fund. You see more detail by asset class. So you have this information in here. You also have brokerage fees and commissions that are listed in here as well. I like this table, top 10 holdings for both public equity and fixed income. So, again, may not be something that we talk about all the time, but know that that's the resource and that information is in here as well. And then we finish off with investment managers here. Next section is the actuarial section. Again, starts off with a letter from Siegel. Again, high-level information about funding and the plan. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here because we spent a lot of time with Siegel last month going through the actuary report. Do just want to say again, the combined pension funded ratio did decline to 41.6% for the January 1st, 2021 valuation. That's down from 45.7%, and that's primarily due to investment losses, to demographic changes, and to assumption changes in this year's actuarial valuation. A lot of charts, again, in here, looking at information in different ways. I like the member information that's on page 220. Where you can see active members. You got 10 years of history. How many members do we have in 2012? What do we have in 2021? Combined plans, supplemental plans. So I think that's interesting information. Same thing for retirees and beneficiaries. So you can see in 2021, it was like 192 new additions to the payroll, 144 removal from the payroll. So you see that growth or that growth in the pension payments that are being made. So 10 years of history there to look at. And then funding progress charts. Again, lots of history so you can see the progress that the system is being made, is making. The last section is the statistical section. This section provides historical perspective, its context, its detail, again, 10-year schedules where you can see combined plans, supplemental plans, or you may see it presented as a consolidated plan since the supplemental plan has so few members to protect that. Starts off with just a couple of pages describing the schedules that you're going to see in this section, and then here is that changes in fiduciary net position, but it's now over 10 years, so you've got that schedule there. And then you see distributions by type, both in chart and table form. And, you know, the large anomaly that you see there, of course, everyone recognizes as the run on the bank, all of the drop money that left the pension at that time. You have distribution, again, by type here. You know, yearly retirements by service years gives you information, how many retired, how long have they been here, you know, what's their average pay. So a lot of good historical information, value of the assets and the funded ratio over a period of time to let you know the progress of the system. So I hope I've intrigued you a little bit, again, about this report that if you haven't seen, you can always think of it as a good resource. It will be on the website. We expect to have it to the printer here in just a few days. If you'd like, we will be happy to mail you a copy to your home address. We can email you a soft copy, or there'll be a hard copy waiting for you at your place here at the January meeting. Just let us know how you would like to receive it.
Great. Okay. And I take mine with me, not everywhere I go, but everywhere I go related to pension business. My only comment is that last year I gave you access to some photo editing software, and I see in my picture you didn't use it. So if anyone else has any suggestions or whatever, you'd promise to take some of the gray out. But, I mean, that's okay. You're still doing a great job. So other than that, we really, really like the report. Like I said, I take mine with me anytime I have any pension-related meeting. It's a great resource. So we'd like a motion to authorize the executive director to issue the 2020 annual comprehensive financial report. Did I get I got the words correctly? Okay, good. Upon its finalization. Do we have a motion?
I'll check it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay.
I'd like a hard copy, too.
Okay.
I think you need a hard copy for everybody. It's a valuable resource.
Oh, yeah. We'll definitely order a hard copy for everyone. It's just a question of would you like it mailed to you so you'll have it before January meeting or just at the January meeting?
January meeting is fine with me.
That's right, me too.
Melissa will probably reach out to each of you and ask your preference, so we'll make sure we can get it to you how you like it.
Thank you.
I like the pictures, too, in there. See, those were cool.
Well, I want to give credit to Melissa. She is our picture guru, and she helps every year. She goes and tries to come up with two or three themes for us, and we went with the signs this year. So kudos. Thank you to Melissa for that.
Yeah.
Bless you. Thank you.
You know, and I assume maybe going forward in trying to get some input from, you know, the officers or firemen, first responders on things they'd like to see, I think that would be cool. Like, are there any, you know, things going forward they would like to emphasize that, you know, maybe just, you know, in terms of just a good way to make it feel like it's their document as well. I love those pictures that we saw there. They were great.
I mean, we would love to have police and fire pictures. We've just found very difficult to find Dallas, not just random ones, but Dallas ones. So we'd certainly love to be able to feature people if we could.
Well, I think what you did this year was fantastic. So now my items to discuss, I guess we have the 2022 calendar. You know, I would expect us to sort of stick with the same protocol we've had. Does anyone have any thoughts or comments on that? Anything you'd like to change? Everyone likes the
page 224, John.
The sequencing?
Sorry. 244? Or 244, sorry.
44. There it is. I like having a consistent schedule and having it out there a year in advance.
I did, too.
Spring break has been a problem for some of July meetings, but I don't know if that anybody knows.
You mean the March 10th?
Right. Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
The March meeting.
Yeah.
I think with the addition of the online access, you know, I think it's pretty seamless.
Okay. All right. Next, I chair the professional services meeting. You know, we met with Chuck Campbell from Jackson Walker last week, and you know, just really nothing to report. You know, he has been a service provider for a long time, and it was, you know, other than just checking in on, you know, his views on how he engages with the pension system, and you know, really no issues and good communication back and forth, so nothing really there. Anyone else who's part of the committee have anything they want to add? Okay.
We plan to bring Chuck in January. Is that still the plan?
Yes, correct. He'll be here in person.
All right. Ryan, to you, portfolio update.
Thank you, Nick. Leo, Aaron, if you guys want to come up to the table, do that now. I'd like to welcome Makita back for the first time in almost 2 years.
And there's a third.
Yeah, Ryan, I don't get his last name yet, but he's with Makita, and he's based in Dallas here.
Oh, he is.
So that's come along to observe.
He's a local guy.
Get out from the computer.
He's a Plano East guy.
Oh, wow.
All right, I'll start, as always, with liquidation of the private markets assets. Year-to-date, we're up to $159 million in proceeds, which is about 25% of the portfolio in 2021. We expect about another $10 million to come back through year-end. We got $7.3 coming back next week from AEW. On rebalancing activity, we've redeployed $123 million into the public asset classes during 2021 towards the new asset allocation. You'll see it in a minute when I go to the allocation chart, but we have about I'm guessing another $35 million to go to lower the safety reserve down to that new target. And then on the international small cap search, we actually have two firms coming in to present to the IAC next week, next Thursday, for review and approval. Expect to have the selection come, we'll present the selection of the IAC at the January board meeting. Getting into returns a little bit, we ended the month at $1.926 billion in NAV, estimated annual return of 1.3% year-to-date, 26% gain, and $96 million has gone out for net benefit payments. So looking at the public markets portfolio, which makes up about 69% of the entire portfolio, which compares to the long-term allocation of 15%, year-to-date, we're up 6.8% in that portfolio compared to the benchmark of 6.2%. Looking at the right side of the page there, you can see kind of the divergence between our active value managers with Boston Partners and Manulife and the 14 to 15% year-to-date return as compared to Invesco, who's the growthiest manager at 11.2%, and Walter Scott, who's more quality at 13%. Move ahead here to, this goes to Mark's point earlier on the drag of the private markets on returns. We're going to show this quarterly. We did this a couple of months ago, but it looks at return contribution of public markets, which is the blue bar, and private markets, which is the pinkish bar. So the average weight for the year in private versus public, and then the return of each. So that 1.8, 1.7 return in 2020, 7.1 uplift from public markets, and then private markets return was negative 13, which contributed 5.3 down to the return. So over the last 5 years, 100% of our positive return has come from the public markets. We looked at just how much more money would we have if we were fully invested in publics over the last 5 years, and it would be, you know, over $300 million more. So it just shows that, you know, the drag and the dollar amount effect of that drag of the private markets has had on the portfolio.
Yeah, and I think it's not private markets per se. It's our legacy private markets. I mean, private markets have been the source of these amazing endowment returns on the June to June year what we see all across the country. So it's the fact that we inherited a subpar, which is a kind phrase, a group of private assets that we've had to do our best in monetizing and working through and so on. We could get rid of all of them today and sell them for a penny, but that would be not the right thing to do. And staff, I think, has done a really good job of kind of wrestling with the timing, the liquidity, maximizing value, and then knowing that we've had this clock ticking and the 6.5% hurdle rate on those same dollars. So if they're not being earned on the private markets, where are they being earned? And if it's not covering for that, then you're just digging a slightly bigger hole all the time, which is what we see in the funded ratio and other metrics like that. So it's a bunch of gears working. We're making great progress on it, but we still have a long, long way to go.
Definitely. And our $1.5 million commitment to venture capital is doing pretty well. So it doesn't make up for everything else, but it's the last commitment we made.
I just recall you used that $300 million number that was, if we were fully allocated to public markets, that I just remember that when I first joined doing the math on average returns for public pensions versus our 10-year return, and it was $1 billion difference over a 10-year period. And it's just the power of compounding returns over time on big numbers. Is you know, profound. So when we look at the history, you know, it's that, it's the matching of the liabilities relating to drop with a funding mechanism for those, and then a structure, you know, that were, where if you structured something where people could take the money out, you need to fund it with that reality in mind. And there was not a matching funding mechanism for what the plan allowed and drop, and so you really have that with these subpar legacy private investments, and you know, from my perspective, those are the biggest sources of the holes, which you know speak to historical issues of governance and controls and all those sorts of things that it just takes a long time to turn the glacier, you know. In a good direction, and I think we're doing that. But you know, we see the evidence of good progress, and we see the residue of past mistakes.
We still have the big issue of our benefit payments exceeding our contributions,
yes.
Creating a hole, and the contributions not being what they need to be.
And I mean, I look at that 1.926. We had a down month in November, but you know, for kind of earning our actual return, we should be hovering around $2 billion. So, looking at the asset allocation here, just a few things to point out. We're pretty equally weighted across the four active global equity managers. We have did the $40 million funding of Eastern Shore, the new U.S. small cap, a month and a half ago. And then looking at the bottom right of the page, you can just see that over allocation of $27 million to the safety reserve. So that plus whatever comes back from private markets in the next couple of weeks we'll use to redeploy likely into global equity, and I'm thinking we'll probably put it in the passive mandate as we have the international small cap funding coming up, so we can park it there until we're ready to fund the new international small cap manager. Hmm. Any questions on allocation or performance before I hand it over to Makita to go more detail? Okay, thank you. Yeah, Leo?
What?
You can drive away.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I still remember. This was the last meeting I had in March of last year. Flew back, and essentially we shut down. And so it's nice to be back. Very nice to see you. So let's spend a few minutes looking at the public market investments primarily. Aaron will focus on the private ones. We've taken your feedback as well as the one from your staff, and have a shorter version of the reports now. So please let us know how you like it, and if you have additional comments, we'll try to adjust and incorporate that. Performance for the last year that ended in September 30th was positive, and if we had gone back a year and said, hey, I think we're going to err on about 8%, think we would have all been happy. The issue is the market's rallied tremendously, and so when you look at that number versus peers or benchmarks, more or less the same story. We're lagging by wide margins, in this case by about 10 percentage points versus the policy benchmark. And when we look into the rationale for that and the attribution, you'll see it's primarily due to the private equity performance of the actual holdings that you have. There's other aspects, but they have the minimus influence, like being overweight real estate and consequently underweight public equities, but that is a very small component of that attribution. If you look in the bottom half of this page, you'll see that the areas you can control, your public investments, have done generally well. 5 out of 9 of your managers beat their benchmarks, and they're doing okay versus the 60-40. And, you know, sometimes they beat, sometimes they lag, but within reason versus peers. And also this includes the safety reserve, which many of your peers don't. So that's a bit of a drag during rallies. Here's the bridge chart that shows the change in market value. This is on a quarterly basis, and you'll see a $50 million loss during the quarter. That's about 2.5%, and we'll look into that as well. And then you have your negative net cash flow that Bill mentioned. We have a deficit. In other words, contributions are lower than the benefit and expenses that go out on a regular basis, and so that is a headwind. And we've known from, you know, recent reports from the actuary, that's going to get a little bit worse before it gets better in the coming years. The liquidity exposure continues to improve over the years, but still we have work to do. So the target is 15% to illiquid assets, and we're now at 28%. And again, you know, as Nick mentioned, a portion of that comprise those legacy assets that have struggled. This is a relatively new addition from this year that the Investment Advisory Committee has requested. It is a scoreboard for your public market strategies in the roster, and essentially we look at 1, 3, and 5 years. At some point in time, we may add 10, but we only have 2 strategies with 5 years. If you go back almost 5 years ago, you only had about 10% of your assets with public equities. So right now we're about 45%. So you'll see that many of the strategies have been funded within the last 5 years. Not too much to take out of these. There is no call of action, meaning that if you're behind 1, 3, and 5 years, you're automatically out. I think it is something to make sure everybody's able to see on a quick snapshot how each manager is performing versus their respective benchmarks. Staff, the IAC, the consultant, Nikita, you know, we continue to monitor, and if we believe there is an action to take, we'll be prompt and share that with you. Also, this table does not really tell you the magnitude of the out or underperformance. So you can be ahead or behind by 10 basis points, and it still comes as the same yes or no versus somebody who might be several percentage points ahead or behind. This is a second chart that we have been asked to include on a regular basis. There's been some questions by some stakeholders in this group that ask about the percentage of investments in the public markets in the U.S. versus developed markets and emerging markets. So we track this, and I think the bottom chart is quite telling. So the blue is the public equity aggregation of your assets for the pension fund, and that's 50% in the U.S. The benchmark, if you look at the broadest benchmark, the All Country World Index, is 58. So we're a bit behind. That was one of the reasons why earlier this year we funded a U.S. small cap strategy. And if you look at the 4 columns in towards the middle, those represent the 4 equity strategies in the global equity space. And there's one that is slightly lower than the rest, that kind of pinkish color, and that is Boston Partners, which, with the value orientation and the current valuation of U.S. stocks, has underweighted that area, and that accounts for, you know, a good amount of the explanation for that underweight to U.S. equities.
And we're doing a deeper dive on the attribution of Boston Partners and underweight to the U.S. as a whole at the IAC next week. So
yeah,
we've got that together. And
we'll report that to you after that with the feedback from the IAC.
Okay.
if we look at performance again versus your policy, here are some of the numbers you saw earlier. So an underperformance of about 10 percentage points, for example, during the last year, and about 5 to 6 when you compound year over year. Nick, as you mentioned, this translates into hundreds of millions of dollars in the short term and well over $1 billion when you look at 10 years. Here is the attribution effect, and this is very telling. So recall that vertical line at the zero level is if everything goes according to par, and essentially there's no excess return. You essentially match the performance of the benchmarks in each asset class, and you're at your target allocations. You're not going to be at your target allocations because sometimes markets move, and you're not able or willing to rebalance, and in some cases you can, like in the private markets. That's reflected on the blue line. The green line represents the value added or subtracted from the strategies you actually hold versus the median or average performance you could have gotten if you were right in the middle, in the midpoint. And so what you see is that most are to the right, which is a good thing, but there is one big one to the left, and that is very negative and very telling. And essentially, the write-downs and write-offs that took place during the last years in your private equity book, and sorry, in your last quarter, account for these, for all of these underperformance during the quarter.
And
so
it was just really the year-end write-downs on the two private equity hit the Makita report in this quarter.
Because we have a quarter lag.
Yeah.
For the private. Yeah. And that's consistent with the way the managers report. For the last year, again, capturing these, but also additional headwinds from the private equity, you'll see the same story. So you're down, again, by about, 8 to 9% behind the policy benchmark, and substantially all is explained by private equity, but also some of the real estate, as you can see below. The rest seems to be doing anywhere from good to decent. This is a comparison. It looks at risk and return, you versus other peer public pension funds, and you're on the bottom left. Quadrant, that's not ideal. You want to be in the upper left. That means you generate a lot of return for the risk that you take. And so this is primarily due to the asset allocation that you have with illiquids that are not moving much, and then, safety reserve also is not moving much. So that explains the risk and then the return. I think we all know why it's low. Let's spend a few more moments, and then I'll turn it over to Aaron. Here we go into more detail on the performance. The top line is defined, and then we have a couple of benchmarks, if you will, to look at. Third or fourth from the top, you'll see the total fund ex private markets. That was something we were asked to include several years ago, so we track that. And you'll see that the fund is doing quite well versus that, and within reasonable bands and expectations. If you look at each asset class, which are bolded, you see global equity all the way to private debt. Most of those are doing quite well. So if you look at global equity, it's beating its benchmark, the equity, I think, across every time period. And if you scroll to the right, most asset classes also since inception are doing quite well. So again, is it the telling of just one or two asset classes with a large weight at the time, private equity and real estate, which have underperformed, which has been the main drag. No areas of concern within the strategies. The one that I would highlight is Ashmore, which is your sole emerging markets debt. It tends to take on a lot of risk. I would describe them as a more of a higher octane strategy. And when the times are good, they perform quite well. When times are not so good, they tend to lag more than average. And, the last few months have been quite telling on emerging markets with issues in China, more recently in Turkey, and those positions have been headwinds. Earlier, there were issues with Argentina, Ecuador, and other parts, and so it's been a fairly volatile strategy of late. And so coming 2022, we might spend some more time revisiting that.
Say, given our strategy of trying to be a little bit more conservative and not hit home runs but not strike out, is that a different manager more likely to meet that objective?
Yeah, we need to look at it. I mean, 75% of their underperformance this year is because of China and Evergrande.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's the right time to get rid of them right now, but we need to look at it harder going into the new year and see if they're
sort of
long-term.
Trying to be even on global equities, we're pretty much where the market is, and we're not trying to be too different from the market.
Mm-hmm.
Try to add value, we're a little So I think we got to look at each manager in that same fashion.
Definitely.
So just to wrap up, the allocation versus the targets, I mentioned, you know, within ranges, but you'll see still we have an underweight. I mentioned almost 5 years ago, you were just at about 10% in public equities. Now you're close to 45, and that we expect to continue to get closer to that 60% target over the next year or two. And lastly, here is the chart that looks at how you have increase your allocation to public equity. Fixed income hasn't changed that much. It's always been fairly constant at that 20 to 30%. And then you've seen the decline in real assets and private equity over time. So the right is where we're aiming for. We're getting closer. Before I pass it over to Aaron to look at private markets, anything you want to address in more detail? I went fairly quickly about the managers, but happy to spend more time.
It's sort of distressing looking at peer groups and benchmarks,
yes.
But I think you got to recognize we're not there. I mean, the real thing to look at is what we can control over time.
Yeah, just one more comment, and I think I heard somebody on the phone, but if you
look at... Can I make a quick comment, Bill? It's going to tag on to yours. This is Gilbert. I just want to make sure, especially for the new trustees, we tend to talk about numbers and throw them around. To move from 10% to 35, 45% public equity is a huge move. And imagine if we had not done that. With the rally that's gone on in the stock market, imagine if we had still had the illiquid assets and had not redeployed it, how bad things would look. And so sometimes we need to take a step back and just reflect on everything. And that's such a heroic move and such a huge move that took a great deal of work. And so I just wanted to sensitize some of the new trustees to that, Bill and Nick.
Understood. Yeah. Okay, that's the preface to the private markets. You know, I'll just highlight the performance of private equity. So you'll see a minus 37% return over the last year, whereas the benchmark was at 54. And so that means there were others that performed better. I've seen clients and others doing 60, 70, almost 80% just over the last year. And if you look to the right, if you compound that 15 or 20% per year and you have 10, 20, even 30% there, that's a huge source of value creation. That has been the primary driver for those endowments and foundations that you mentioned, Nick, and for other, you know, pension funds as well. And so that, yeah, it's what...
At some point, I don't know if it's now or after Aaron talks, you know, one of the things we value in all of you is that you have eyes and ears throughout the industry, and you see what peer firms are doing, not doing, and so on. So we would like any comments of things you're seeing. You know, I remember when we first met with you all, there was, I think, a Louisiana pension that was analogous, you know, somewhat to this. And so, you know, at any point, if there's any kind of things you would say that other people are doing or you're seeing or have you thought about this type stuff, you know, we'd love to get that feedback.
Yeah, on that note, Nick, having worked with that client the closest, I'll mention, you know, the progress is being made. It takes a while to see it in the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to get to a clean portfolio and then let the portfolio work for 1 year, 3 years, and then you see it. So that client is just seeing it now after 3+ years of kind of getting back to normal. So you'll get there. It's just a matter of being patient and
disciplined.
And being disciplined, not...
You got to see it through.
You got to see it through and recognize that the peer numbers, take them with a grain of salt. Peers aren't going through the same circumstance.
I mean, what most people are doing, and we just are not in a position to do, is they're adding to their private equities and their growth capital.
Yes.
Because of our liquidity, we just can't do that. So we're going to probably, you know, trail benchmarks and peers because they're doing more and more of that, but we're doing what's right for the system. We've got to get the liquidity back before we can consider that and get rid of the illiquid assets.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say, because there's always I see my kids with FOMO, and I think I probably have it sometimes too, and you certainly see it in this world, is that, you know, these amazing numbers that these endowments put out on a June to June year. So it started from a low denominator because of COVID, and then, you know, we've had unbelievable markets. There's a big portion of the private market return that really is not as provable and as solid as a public market's return. And, you know, Aaron sort of rolling his eyes, I think, in somewhat agreement, you're seeing all sorts of things going on in the private markets where assets get valued by valuations, they get valued by comparable things. You have, and it's, you know, a funky investment word, rehypothecation occurring in the private market on steroids.
Yep.
Where firms are buying pieces of each other. There's these things called continuation funds. There's GPs going public. There's GPs buying pieces of each other. There's private equity firms who sell minority interests, and they take the mark. The person buying it takes the mark. And there's all sorts of things going on, which is not as legitimate as a public currency that, you know, you buy $10 a share and then it's worth $12 a share and you say it's up 20%, because you can go into the market and realize the sale that, you know, on any given day within some sort of volume limitations. In the private markets right now, you know, there's sophistication going on at levels that, you know, those of us that touch it understand some of it. No one understands all of it right now. But it really is not, in my view, a return I'm seeing in private markets. I don't take it as fully as real as I think of a return in the public markets on liquid public securities. And
I mean, the real return is what you realize, but we,
right,
are seeing a trend towards shorter amounts of time before going public. And that validates or invalidates what those valuations are. But, yeah, no, you're exactly right. The markup values are, they're not real until you actually realize them.
But they're being treated as apples and apples with public market returns for purposes of reporting like this.
Yeah.
So if I may, valuations have risen tremendously and over a very short amount of time. But the same can be said of stock and
bonds. That's what I was going to say.
That
the exuberance.
The one
market.
Thing is, if you follow the cash, then that is real returns. And while there may be some valuations that get marked and then get reported and there's no realization yet, there's also another part of the story. And we do have clients that were in a net cash flow position for years and years, and the distributions over the last 12 months have been so strong, and several of those are Texas clients, and we've been having these meetings, that not only do they become cash flow positive to fund future private equity investments, they get enough distributions, they are paying all benefits, and then they have extra cash to redeploy into their assets. And there's
wow.
a couple of Texas
wow.
funds that are going through that now. So there is some of that, but there's also distributions coming back at the fastest pace, probably in record.
Agreed, but distributions and returns are highly correlated. They're not the same thing. They're highly correlated, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But if you look longer term, which is what you really got to do, forget the last year or two or three, but if you look over 10-year periods of time, some of these private investments have added 200 to 300 basis points versus the public markets,
yeah.
if done right.
Correct.
And that's the reason people are putting more in there, not that they think they can repeat 50 and 60.
Yeah.
But if the public markets are going to be at 8, hopefully they're going to get 10 or 11.
Yeah, and I guess my point is that in the last year or two, the amount of money pouring into the private markets is so profound and so unprecedented. In response to that, the level of sophistication and the number of products and the number of financially engineered products in private equity has exponentially grown. And what that all means to what's real and what will be realizable and what gets reported is a story still yet to be played out. In my opinion.
And to your point, I think there's $940 billion in uncommitted private equity money
wow.
waiting to be deployed.
Wow.
And,
It's a huge number.
It's paying 1.5 to 2% management fees to somebody.
Yeah.
Taking their GP public and sold 10% to somebody else who's raised the fund and, you know.
And there will be winners and there will be losers, and that's the issue here. There's going to be a huge dispersion of returns, and we've seen them in these reports, and that's another reason. So if the markets will give you X and that X is not enough, and there is the possibility if you execute well, then some people are willing to take on that trade. And for some it will work, for others it won't. Aaron?
For not about it, it's the time to be an owner or a partner in a private equity company. All right, so we'll wrap up with this report. I think it's important to remind everyone what this report is and what it isn't. First of all, that date is accurate, June 30th. You know, we're almost to the end of the year. So this private market report, you know, this is a resource for a point in time. It's analogous to the reports we talked about at the start of the meeting. So given the valuation lag or delay to get in private equity, private debt, real estate, you know, the valuations come out, say, 2 to 4 months after the date. So this report gets compiled usually, say, in, like, September, October, and we come here today. So it's helpful for understanding exposure at a point in time and performance at a point in time. I think if you want, you know, current, up-to-date, where's the money coming back from, where the distribution is coming from, then staff's reports are your best source for that. But this is still a relevant kind of summary of information, but I don't think you're going to hear anything groundbreaking in this that hasn't already been shared through a number of the other updates you get every month. So we start with big picture. We always show you exposure and then performance in graphical form and table form. And then it goes down into each asset class. This is a high-level exposure. If you add up all these pieces to the chart, it's about $620 million. So still work to be done, but that number was over $1 billion just a few years ago. So exposure has come down through sales, through distributions, and unfortunately, in some cases, simply through write-downs and decrease in valuation. The biggest chunks remain in real estate, private equity. The other point is this is a report of the current private market investment. So any asset that was fully sold off comes off this report. You can see here, basically it spent a lot of time and effort and got, on paper, your money back, basically a zero return. So if you look at the gain-loss column, you can see about $8 million, and this is on-paper gain, so this goes to Nick's point. You still have a lot of value in terms of how these are marked, so this isn't an accounting cost, money in and money out. But about an $8 million on-paper gain on $1.5 billion that we invested in. So you see the gain-loss column. A major home run asset has been the ag portfolio, the Hancock portfolio. You've been invested there for, I think, almost 3 decades. And it's done very well. So $200 million in gain. And then you see to the far right in IRR, so basically your performance per year, close to 15%. But that's essentially fully offset, fully nullified by, and again, no surprise, private equity and real estate. So you see the mirror story there, and then the final number on the page in the bottom right, 0.1 IRR. So again, that's basically close to zero as you could get. So that so the ag portfolio has, the gains there have save the day in terms of not showing a negative number here, but a lot of energy, a lot of time, and a lot of opportunity cost loss with this portfolio. So we go through each asset class. You see here's private equity. You get the these bar charts showing multiples. And then
hold on, go back. That's the one on venture that Ryan mentioned earlier. It's some good performance. It's a small investment in venture, but it's the one to the right that, you know, it's compounding at 2+X.
Who's on that paper. Who's the venture firm?
Industry Venture.
There's a secondary fund-to-fund, so you get kind of broad exposure.
The $5 million commitment, one of the last ones I think you made, probably 2016, just before we
came
aboard.
Yeah, that and Riverstone were the last two.
Yeah, you see here 30% IRR there with that fund. So not in that 50% range that you see some of these endowment funds, but as to be expected in a fund-to-fund, you're getting such a diversified portfolio. But 30%, you know, that's kind of...
And to the previous...
market.
Discussion. It's all on paper right now. So
yeah. So just you've heard this from staff, but this is the first report now where the Lone Star write-downs that were memorialized in the annual report are getting reflected in our reports. So you see some zeros there for Lone Star Growth Capital and Opportunities 5. And then the other one, Lone Star CRA, had a big write-down as well. All told, about $57 million. That plus, inclusive of HUP, about $57 million less in exposure to private equity from this report versus last. So that explains the charts Leo showed you earlier and basically why for the quarter you were in the negative terms instead of a slightly positive. Again, not new information, but this is always a good resource if you want to see where you're at a point in time, compare it back to a point in time. Positive of taking swallowing those hard pills is you know, you're limiting, hopefully, future tips because you're already incurring them. I'm going to go and just end on one positive investment. So everyone knows what's going on with the shipping industry and the supply chain issues. So you have benefited from some of this near-term, short-term challenges in your maritime fund. So this value is up about $8 million from where it was 3 months prior. So you got a decent kind of clawback in some performance here. That was around $27 million the first quarter, up to $35 million here.
And we've started to see some distributions of that fund, too, and I'd expect into 2022 that's one of the private equity ones that is going to be sending semi-regular amounts back to us.
And then we always have this as a resource, so you can see what seems like we have a lot of exposure still in the fund in some of these private market portfolios. These two pages are all the commitments that have fully played out. So DPSP was, you know, heavily invested, 10 years ago. So these are all the funds that are that were invested on the book and fully paid back.
So these are all ones that have ended or that are still outstanding?
No, those are totally in.
So these produce $1.13 for every dollar invested, but that's probably over a 8 to 10 year return period. So that might be, you know, 1.5% type, you know, or 2 at most. The IRR, would you kind of guess?
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, and this is private equity debt with the 1.13. The prior page has its own total line at the bottom, and that's real assets, mostly real estate.
So real estate is 98 cents, and then private equity, excluding real estate, $1.13.
And about a third of that private equity came back to the secondary sale in 2016.
and real estate looks like it's 60% and private equity is 40%. So if you kind of average those two together, it's probably like $1.05. So just think about, you invest a dollar, you tie it up for 10 years, and at the end of 10 years, someone gives you $1.05, and you didn't have use of that dollar to do all other things that you could have done to generate a return. What's the rule of seven? So if you hit 7%, you double every 10 years. So, and 7% was a good public pension sort of return number. So, you know, once again, just to get a sense of magnitude for glaciers over time and how they move or don't move.
So now that concludes our section here. And first half of next year, we'll revisit the asset study where we forecast returns for the future and what impact that has on your asset mix.
Hey, Aaron, this is Michael Brown. I had a question on the Lone Star valuation. Is there the zero? Is there no potential value in remaining portfolio assets in those funds?
Mike, it's Ryan. That's an internal valuation. We're going to talk about Lone Star a little bit later, okay. Closed session. So there's a few things we're working on across the funds that we can talk about.
Okay.
And then, like what I said before, is there anything you're seeing in the industry that you're, or with other clients, that you'd want to flag for us?
The one thing I wanted to add to that was the, you know, in this market where it's really been one directional outside of those 3 months, first of 2020, the plans that don't have pay a significant benefit payment every month have really enjoyed the compounding effect of kind of letting the winners ride. The others that have to always kind of trim their equities, and you guys have done it a little different, but it's really showing big magnitudes of difference for the first time in a while for those that can just like let the compounding compound versus the others that are always trimming after a little gain and never letting their equities run up as much. So I would argue another fortunate challenge, you know, this plan versus others is that you have others are benefiting from just doing nothing and letting and not having to sell the winners early, whereas organizations like yourself.
What are you seeing though? I mean, we've got a lot more inflation expectations now than we did 6 months ago, where it's not transitory, et cetera. I mean, are people doing anything who would take advantage of that opportunity?
To be honest, there's a lot of talk, but not a lot of changes in terms of what they do to their portfolios. And if anything, I wouldn't say people that make changes are taking advantage. I'd say more like they're getting defensive, trying to avoid, you know, hits to their nominal bonds.
And to Aaron's point on with the reduction of the safety reserve and putting more money into equity this year, we've been able to kind of let the winners ride this year. But as we get down to target at the end of this year, going into 2022, we're going to have to be, you know, clipping $9 million a month from somewhere in the portfolio. There'll be some private market distributions coming back to hopefully cover most of it, but we're going to be back into that mode.
Yep.
All right. I can move ahead to the IAC discussion now. So we got two members of the IAC whose terms are ending at the end of this year, Rakesh and Bill Velasco. Rakesh would like to stay on the IAC, which is great news. So we want to reappoint him for another two-year term. Bill Velasco is going to step off the IAC, so we're going to need to look for a few additional members. And there's a few people that have expressed interest in the role, and just we need to appoint them in January just because of some external constraints. So we have a few very, you know, they'll be great members to the IAC, but we'll talk about them in January. And I think what we want to do is think about expanding the IAC. Right now the IPS caps it at 7, so it's 3 from the board and 4 external. And that's caused a little bit of a quorum issue. If one person external can't come to the meeting, we don't have a quorum and we can still have the meeting, but it just adding additional outside members, I think, would be good if we get qualified members that are willing to join, and also helps with the quorum issue. So
what the quorum issue is, you said one outside person doesn't show up, you still have what, 2 others?
So there has to be a majority at the meeting of outside members. And the 3 board members show up to every meeting. So if we have 3 and 3.
You should send them home or send one.
Yeah, we could say listen but don't talk. But, yeah, it's
simple math number.
Yeah. So it just gives us more wiggle room by adding.
Look at adding, maybe going to
the Yeah, I mean, what we might do is say in the policy a minimum of 7, which gives us the most flexibility. We might say a maximum of 9. There's multiple ways to do it. At least 2.
Gilbert, do you have any comments just on the committee in general, how it's functioned?
I can barely hear you, but I think you said, do I have a comment? I think the comment is, you know, we want the board participation on the IAC, and so just by how it's set up, that means we just need to have even more outside members. But we're going to strike the right balance, and I think what we're doing now is making sure we have balance among the IAC members and have a adequate diversity. But there's a lot of good candidates that that we're touching base with, so I expect it to be continuing very, very strong members. And we'll have an update for everyone here at the next meeting.
And who takes the initiative in recruiting members? Is it staff?
Well, right now it's been a combination of, Ryan's done some, diligence. Bill and I have been in close contact and calling names. So right now there hasn't been a formal process, but it's been working, because we have a very strong group, and we're going to be adding, at least 1, if not probably 2 more, and I expect them to be equally as strong.
I still have a strong network within that community, so if I get a name or indicate somebody who may be interested, I'll pass it on to Nick or Ryan or Kelly, so they could vet him to see if, and Gilbert as well, to see if that's somebody that thinks it would make sense. So I'm going to give him some input on that.
And so, Gilbert, Michael, Ken, what are the things you're looking for, and specifically beyond the broad qualifications on members?
Sure. I think
go ahead, Gilbert.
I think you said, I can barely hear you. I apologize. I think you said, what are we looking for? We continue to look for very strong people. We really want the IAC to remain, to use the term race time, bulletproof. So everybody is significant experience in markets, whether they have been allocators, consultants, managers, but they're all very well versed in all aspects of the markets, both top down from a macroeconomic standpoint and bottom up from different products. And so we're seeking a very strong pedigree in all of these people. And it has been working. It's been maybe a little less formal, but it's been working well, Nick.
How often do you all meet?
Quarterly.
Quarterly.
Yeah, we've done a few times twice a quarter, but.
Yeah. We're prepared to meet as needed. And when as needed could increase typically around when there's search activity, meaning manager search activity.
And just like Nick, like you were asking me, a broad base investment knowledge, so we get a bias knowledge out there that we can all make decisions on. get input from all of them. They're not only attorneys who do this, or not only investment analysts, or whatever they are, broad knowledge of everything involved in the investment world. And as I said in one of the board meetings, I'll put the way we against any pension system in the country, because this works, and it's worked very well, me being part of it before, when I was on the board before, and I also was on the advisory committee. It's like a difference of night and day, and of course, adding two more to it will only strengthen it. So yeah, I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah, I know Bob Jones. He's excellent. I mean, just
yeah, Nick, the tenure of these people in the business is averaging probably 30 years.
Yeah.
So you've got really high-quality people, and
yeah.
I think some of the folks you're thinking about are will fit that same definition. So, I mean, yeah, it is a really premier group.
Except me. I'm the
dummy.
No exceptions. The whole thing.
Well, that's why you're third.
Okay.
Okay, I think we need a motion to reappoint Rakesh. Is that correct?
I have two points, just real quick. Number one, should we not codify who's responsible for filling the vacant committee seat? Okay, maybe put that on the committee chairman to make sure that I know it's working informally right now, but I just don't want that to slip through the cracks and where, oh, I thought you were handling it. No, I thought you were handling it. No, it ultimately falls on you.
I think you can do that. The chairman can recommend, but this board has to have
right.
authority.
But yeah. The chairman has to bring them forth.
Sure. Okay.
And then, am I looking at it right, where they all roll off December of 22, except for Bill? There's two down there.
Rakesh.
Yeah, Rakesh and Bill.
Well, and the two new people, presumably,
okay.
would be 23, I would assume.
Okay.
So you'd start to have, but yeah, no.
I just want to bring note to that we need to get ahead of that.
Yeah. You got the same thing. If you look at the comprehensive report on the board,
yeah.
you've got a lot of people rolling
yeah.
out in 22.
Yeah. To Ken's point, the IAC is working very well now compared to in previous years, and we want to continue that because we want to keep this thing moving forward. So just wanted to bring
chairman,
that point.
Does the chairman also have to recommend the addition of outside advisors?
No, I mean, that's a policy thing as far as how many we can have
okay.
on there. I mean, the board has to approve any member, internal or external, mm-hmm. for the IAC. That's not a policy. That's a current policy. The policy changes to increase, but the current policy is the board approves all members.
That's all I have to.
Yeah, we can look at staggering it if we can. I'm not sure we can do that by policy, but, you know, for the most part, people that have been on IAC, there's not term limits, and they've been wanted, you know, most of them have been appointed, so we haven't made major issues so far.
Okay,
so give a second. All in favor? Any
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Mark Kelly?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, everybody. We are getting a lot of feedback from the people on the phone, so if you're not talking or don't have a question, if you could mute, that might be helpful. I have the contribution report, which is on page 311 of the packet. It's the same that you've seen now for many, many months, and the trend is the same that you've seen for many months, which is a good thing. On page 311, you'll see in the fourth bullet or fifth bullet, I guess, that the actual number of employees was down 124 actual people from the hiring plan. Fire was over by 55, and police was under by 179, so it nets to the 124. However, because of the raises that they have given in the last couple of years, the compensation that they're paying the firefighters and police officers is keeping pace, and so forth. Our contributions are as well. On 312, this shows that this is the October report. In October, there were two payrolls. We received $11.4 million in contributions, which was 104% of the hiring plan and 97% of the floor.
Since inception, the system has received contributions of $565 million from the city. $42 million of that, $42.8 million, is due to the floor. They are about just over the hiring plan estimate. So things are on trend to what we've been seeing lately. Are there any questions about the contribution report? No? Okay. The next item that I have is also one that you see every month, and this is on page 317. This is the education and travel for the board. I don't have any requests to attend any travel or anything like that. We do have several classes listed on page 117 and 118 of your information. One of the things I did want to point out is the second item here, which is the TechSpurse annual conference in April. That's actually in Fort Worth this year. We do have budget for all the trustees, so we could pay for your registration if you want to go out there, especially some of the trustees that haven't gone. You might want to go out there and do that as well. They do offer trustee training at those. However, you are all current on your training. I think Armando is the next one that needs training, and that's not until June of 2022, so you don't need it at this point, but you might want to attend that conference. Is there anybody that wanted to add their name to any of these trainings at this point?
I mean, I put in, but I can wait till next month.
Okay, that's fine. If you do, if you have interest or want more information, Carol can help you out with that as well. Is it okay to move on to the next item?
Yes.
Okay. This item is a little more hopefully interesting than the last two that I talked about. So you'll recall in the end of 2019, the board asked staff to look at peer organizational expenses and staff compensation. And we brought back the organizational expenses early on in 2020, and then in March of, actually, we did that in 2020. My years are all confused from being at home. But basically, in March of 2021, this year, we had Logic Compensation Group come to the board and present information from a compensation study that they had done. And they had looked at both compensation as well as benefits. You'll recall Lori Messer was with Logic Compensation Group. She presented a very big report. There were some good things that came out of that report, but we had some irregularities with some of the data. So what we did and what the board directed us to do at that meeting was to take her information really as kind of the first step and continue on and develop a full-blown, basically, compensation strategy. So that's what we did. So Lori's recommendations coming out of her first step was to consider the evaluation of the retirement plan, and you know last month we took action on that, to adopt a formal salary structure and ranges for all jobs, to develop salary administration guidelines, and consider modifying medical premiums, the medical premium share, to be more competitive in the market. So we haven't addressed the medical piece, and the reason for that is when we renewed our health premiums at the end of 2020 for 2021, instead of doing a 12-month contract, we did a 15-month contract because that helped us with rates, but it also, we're such a small plan, getting us off the end of the year is a good thing. So we actually are not looking at those medical costs for another couple months, and we will take a look at all of our health offerings when we do that with the broker. So that piece is still to come. But what we've done on the salary piece is since working with Lori, we contracted with CBIZ. And CBIZ is their name, official name is CBIZ Talent and Compensation Solutions. They're well known in the public pension space for salary surveys as well as in other spaces as well. They also have an arm that does a lot of executive recruiting, so people are familiar with them from that. And I failed to mention that this report actually starts on page 320 of Diligent and your PDF. So the first step we took was we provided DPFP's salary survey information to CBIZ so we could participate in their annual big pension plan survey. And that's a survey that they do with 74 or 75 big pension plans, some local plans like ours, but a lot of the big state systems. And if we provided our information, then we got their results for free. So we got those results, and we were hoping that we could take the results from that public pension survey and develop a salary structure for that. What we found is we got some information, but the majority of our positions really weren't covered in there. So what we then did was we contracted to do a special survey, a special study with CBIZ just for DPFP. And that's what this is. So CBIZ did this study, and we received the results just a couple of days ago. They are available to come talk to the board if you have further questions. We can bring them in next month. So if you have questions that I can't answer, don't feel pressured to make any decisions or anything like that. But the concepts are the same of what we talked about in March with Lori. So hopefully I can answer your questions. But I'll talk to you a little bit about what we did here with CBIZ on our local. So that is very small on the screen, so I'm going to look at my screen. On page 322, we engaged CBIZ, as I said, to really look at the DPFP plan, and they looked at not just kind of the pension-specific positions that we have, but really all of our positions, from the receptionist to the executive director, and they looked at specific organizations as well as their broader surveys, because in some positions we don't compete just against pensions. And they developed a system for that. They also helped us come up with some policies, and I'll talk about those. On 323, the objectives of the study are here, and it's really just to make sure that we're paying competitively so we can attract and retain and motivate qualified individuals. The scope was to do a market analysis of base salary and total cash compensation. They didn't look at benefits, it was just salary and bonuses type things. Develop a salary structure, reconcile our compensation to the market compensation, and then calculate any implementation costs based on their study, and then create overall recommendations, and that's what this study does. This is this next page is just the definitions. If you have any questions about, you know, base salary is your base compensation, total cash includes base plus any bonuses. In their reports, they talk about the 25th, the 50th, and the 75th percentile. The 50th percentile is really the midpoint. The 25th percentile is not the minimum. And it gets confusing because they don't often report the minimum and the maximum. But basically, the 25th percentile, 25% of the people make below that, 75% of the people make above that. But they don't publish an actual minimum on some of their salary stuff. The comp ratio is how far really you are from that minimum. The competitive market and their labor influences are on the next page on 325. They really looked at the size of DPFP, although they did compare to some larger Texas plans. They looked at Dallas. They looked at some private sector information when it was appropriate and the industry to come up with their information. This next slide in the middle of the page, a little above the middle of the page, looks at the peer groups that they included specifically. They have a database of surveys that influence the information, but they specifically looked at the 12 plans that are listed in the middle of page 326 here. So it's Austin Fire, City of Dallas employees, El Paso employees, Denver employees, El Paso Fire, Fort Worth employees, Houston Fire, employees, Jacksonville Police and Fire, Tacoma employees, Teachers Retirement System of Texas, and Texas Municipal System. When Lori did her study, she looked at, wrote it down, basically seven of the same, six of the same city. She was not able to get the Houston firefighters. She didn't have the big Texas plans in there or El Paso employees, and she had some other out-of-state system. The reason Jacksonville and Tacoma, the reason Jacksonville and Tacoma and Denver are in this study is because CBIZ first went out and did this, and they didn't have enough matches for certain positions. So they picked those from their database based on the size of our system, and that's why they're added here. This just shows really how they look at the information. They go out and they survey what's, and they develop a midpoint. And from that midpoint, what this example shows, is that's where they really slot the position, and then they develop a range around that. So the range might be 40%. So they would build a range 20% below that midpoint and 20% above that, and that's how they develop basically the range for that job. If you have questions as I go,
Kelly, I don't think you're matching on the screen.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yep, I'm trying to use two hands and chew gum. So if I forget to fast forward, please let me know. Here's the example where they do the market study, and that becomes the midpoint, and then they build the range around that midpoint. They're not really surveying the minimum and the maximum. They survey the minimum, and they build the range from there. What they did. Okay, so they did provide detailed information by position, and my plan here today is to talk to you about overall where everybody kind of ended up, all the employees together ended up, but not go into specific positions. And then my recommendation would be is after the meeting, I sit down with Nick specifically and talk about where individual job titles would be slotted into the various grades. That's my plan, unless you have another recommendation. The summary of the recommendation, when they did their findings was that they found that DPFP's average base salary is 106.6% above the midpoint. So that means we're slightly above the midpoint if you look at all employees together. It's not in this report, but I did ask him to tell us how that compares by each employee group. And by employee group, I asked him, he did it by department, but I also asked him to compare executives, exempt, and non-exempt employees. And the executives are 120% above the midpoint. But nobody's below the minimum or above the maximum based on the grades they developed. The exempt employees are 104.2% above the 50% midpoint. There are a couple of employees that are above the maximum. Nobody's below the minimum. And then on the non-exempt employees, they're 104.4% above the midpoint. I do have a couple of employees below the minimum and a few employees above them, or one employee I could think above the maximum.
Well, one thing I would point out, this is plus or minus 20%. Most of the ones I see are plus or minus 30%.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, you may want to consider that, and I don't know if that affects any of the minimums or not, but it gives you a broader range on both ends of bringing in people where you think they should be, and then, but also having more upside from them as well.
Okay, and you'll see that I think they've built this in because some of these ranges are actually pretty large from what I've kind of seen in the past, but this is their recommendation. So their initial cost to implement, their recommendation would be that anybody that is below the minimum, we obviously would need to bring them up to the minimum, and that would be a total cost of $6,792 for the system for the year. The three employees that are above the maximum, the recommendation would be that we freeze them so that we're not building into that base. They would be eligible for a lump sum payment if that was deemed appropriate. So here is another way to look at that, and I'll skip these recommendations. Well, I can talk about them, but then I'll show you where those numbers fall in just a moment. So basically they're saying just what I said, increase the compensation for all the employees that are above or below the minimum, implement the compensation plan for everybody. Don't just pick and choose. The compensation plan applies to some employees and not others. Look at the structure annually, which is part of the policies that we would do, and freeze employees that are at the max and review the information
look at it every year and then review it in depth every 3 to 5 years. Those are their recommendations. The way the numbers fell out is shown here in a couple of different ways. This first line chart shows the market 50th percentile, which is the black dots, with a linear line going through it, compared to the brown dots, which is where DPFP falls. So you can see we're pretty close together on the lower ends of the pay scale, but as you get into the higher level positions, we're quite a bit higher than the line of the 50th percentile of the market. That's just on base salary. When you look at this next slide, which is total cash compensation, those dots are a lot closer together. So what that's kind of telling you is we have some positions that are above or below the market. Most of them are pretty close to the line, but probably on the higher end, there is more of a combination of incentive pay plus base salary, but the system changed that 6 years ago to not compensate that way. So in total compensation, we're pretty close to the lines of the market. This is the salary structure, this page 333, that they developed. And again, the way that they developed this structure is CBIZ went out, they looked at their salary data. They read our job descriptions, not just the titles, and they matched what the duties of our jobs were to the midpoint of the market. And from that, they developed a range. So that midpoint number, which is the third column over, is what's matched. And then they recommended the second column from the right of how big should the spread be around that. And they plotted the minimum and the maximum of the range. And you can see grade one is the lowest grade, and we actually haven't slotted anybody into grade one. That has a 25% range spread, whereas you get up to grade 17, that's a 65%. And the reason it's a narrower range on the short end and a bigger range on the higher end is because the theory is if you come in on the lower end of the job grades, from the time you come in as an entry person really brand new to that job to when you're an expert is a much shorter time frame versus when you come in to the higher level jobs, it takes you a lot longer to really become an expert at that job. Are there questions about this? The last column is the market differential, so that's really the difference between the midpoint of one grade to the midpoint of the other grade. That's what that column is.
There's no designation for basically our size relative to the number of people we have in functional roles. So if some other comparably sized fund had 50% more staff, that is not somehow factored into this in any way, shape, or form, right?
We're not seeing it in this report,
yeah.
But I do know that they did look at their big public pension fund survey, and in that survey, the one with the 74, 75 people, they have that broken down by there's one number for all organizations, and then it's broken into internally managed investments, externally managed, and then there's three classes for asset size, and I think four for the number of employees you have, and then another group for however many members you have. So you can slice and dice it all kinds of ways.
A couple of comments. I mean, I clearly we should be looking at total cash, not just base salary. Either that or we should think about an incentive plan, but one or the other. I mean, so at this point, looking at total, and I would think before we freeze anybody's salaries, we want to review that separately to see if that's appropriate or not. I'm not in favor of freezing salaries without knowing a little bit more.
Right. And I think when my plan was when I sat down with Nick, I'll talk about this, you know, this job title is plotted at a grade 9, and this is why. And I can tell you that there are a couple of positions that the salary survey came back, and CBIZ slotted them in one place, and I've either moved them up one level or down a level. I didn't move anybody more than one level, but that was for I know this position does this here, which is really critical, versus I might have some, like for one instance, all my accounting or admin clerks right now are in one grade, and I think some of them have higher levels, so I've split those. So I've done a few little tweaks like that, nothing to the executive, but moved a few around just based on our system that I want to talk to Nick about.
You've got information on ERF here, but on total cash compensation.
They use that in here. I don't have those.
Oh,
yeah. I have old data. I have, like,
they're not going to give it. They're not going to give it updated.
I do have
very relevant data.
It was very relevant, but I don't think they're going to give it up.
Well, I do. They have gotten it, but it might be 2020. It might be about a year old.
This is well done. This is what I would expect to see.
Yeah.
The process and all the metrics they're using, how they're going about it. This is the proper process to do it and to look at it. Nowhere I could help, I'd be happy to. But this is what I think.
Great. Could I just for the size of the systems that were compared, do you also keep the funding, the percent funding? Because is it a good quality of that? Is that asset? In other words, if like hypothetically $2 billion, but it's 50% under, like, you know what I mean? So the quality of the size of the fund is going to matter because it's the retention, right? So it was actually factored in at all. Can you do that?
It wasn't factored in, but that's why I think where we have to use our professional judgment.
Right.
And so I think every system can say they're unique, and I think they are in their own special ways. I mean, Lord knows we're unique in our special ways with our illiquid investments and our litigation and certain things like that. But there's, you know, one of the Austin plans I know is $1.2 billion, and they only have 3 employees, and somehow they've done it. I think they outsource everything.
Right.
But everybody is just so different, it's hard to look at that. But the funding is an issue. That,
right.
Yeah,
it's a risk, right?
You may not want to just look at assets. You may want to look at the liability.
Right. That's a good point. But if you can adjust for that risk,
yeah.
If you kind of can put some metrics to that, you can. I think, because then if you put that, I think the hour band would be closer to the median.
So this next slide is the same information, just hourly, so that's not that helpful. This chart, I think, is actually very helpful. So this is the chart of where everybody falls within their range. And you can see the brown lines going out get wider because as you go up the grades are going up from the bottom grade 1 to the top grade 17. It's a wider range. So it takes longer to get up to that maximum percentage. But you can see right now, most everybody's within their range on the grade line that we've plotted them into, with the exception of a couple of employees. You know, there's one employee that's an outlier. Well, that employee's been here for a very, very long time, and that's why. And there's a brand-new employee that's kind of an outlier on the other side, brand-new employee, and, you know, apparently we were maybe under when we hired that position. So this just graphically tells you where people are at this point compared to the midpoint. This slide is the exact same information, just in a different format. The bars are the range, the minimum to the maximum. The line in the middle, which is a little hard to see on the screen, is the midpoint. And then the dot is where an incumbent or incumbents are if it's a multi-person class, and the dots could be on top of each other.
I would think, and again, this chart here, we'll go back one, I think it's hard to explain to employees that it's a small group that, you know, if you come in, you only got a 15% range, and you get up, you get 35. Having the same range at a wider range, 25 or 30, makes more sense for everybody and gives you more flexibility.
That's one, I think that's a philosophy I've seen out there, and definitely could work. The rationale for this is that in my conversations with CBIZ is that you would typically hire somebody with, you know, between the minimum of the range and, you know, quarter up to the midpoint maybe, depending on their experience. And by the time they get to that midpoint, they know their job pretty well. And it's really only after the midpoint that you see that they're really becoming kind of an expert at their job, or they've just been here a longer time and been rewarded for that. So the idea here is by the time they get to the midpoint or above, they're really pretty good at their job. And that's why sometimes, let's say, John left, which he's never going to do, but in 100 years, if John leaves the system, I am not going to hire a brand-new IT manager that's never been an IT manager before.
So I'm going to probably bring in an IT manager that's midpoint or above and not below, because I want them to be good at that. If I bring a brand new receptionist in, though, I'm fine with bringing them in, and I would expect them to be a really good receptionist in a couple years. So that's, I think, the rationale of the different ranges, but we can certainly talk about
it. Think about it. I mean, I think whatever you think is comfortable with. It's simpler and easier to understand and gives you more flexibility, that's all.
That's true.
Based upon what you know, what you're thinking, getting a little bit ahead of our discussion, is the numbers that Brenda has, is the budget for next year, are we within that pot?
We are in that pot. So just to bring those couple positions up to the minimum is, what did I say, $6,700. And we have a 3% raise built in to our budget. The CBIZ said that the market actually moved like 3.2% last year, so I think that's in the market. I might end up with needing to pay a little bit more with some internal adjustments where I'm changing a title or two. The only thing that would really change that could impact the budget is if, when I sit down with Nick, if we say, you know, no, I don't think that position should be this level, needs to be this level, and then people fall out of the range. But I don't anticipate a big expenditure that we couldn't handle.
I think we also can assume with the lag of information on which we're making real-time decisions that salary increases this year across peer groups are going up a lot more than they have historically. Just as anecdotal, would anyone disagree with that?
There's usually a little bit of a lag factor, but if you want to get ahead of losing people, yes.
Right. Well, we just heard from in the audit committee meeting that it's really hard to hire accountants, especially in Dallas because of all the relocated.
What are the guys from Makita? Y'all seeing people getting
movement?
Yeah, I would think.
Yep. It's a tight labor market.
A lot of poaching going on.
Yep.
February and January after year-end bonuses are out.
Ah, that's right. Okay,
so the next part of this presentation really is on page 337, and the other part that we asked CBIZ to help us with is help us design policies around how we should implement this compensation system. And they did that, and they gave us a draft, some policies, and the policies were actually a lot more robust than an organization our size needs, so we pared them down and changed them to meet our needs. But the objectives of these policies are listed here on page 337. There's 8 objectives listed, and I'm not going to read them all, but the ones that are most important to me are basically to ensure that DPFP's number 2, to ensure that DPFP's financial resources are used in the most effective and efficient manner. Number 3, provide a rational basis for making pay decisions and thereby establishing internal fairness and a consistent approach. Number 4 is really important because right now we really don't have any transparency to the employees on what should you expect, are you going to get topped out, what's the future hold. So this way we would be able to say, here's your range, here's where you are, here's what you can expect. To me, that's just absolutely huge. To make sure we remain competitive, we are losing an employee that happens to be in this room sitting at the back table. Damien is leaving us, and I was told it was for salary reasons, but I don't know any specifics, but Damien will be missed. So hopefully we won't lose other employees due to salary in the future. And the last one is to help us in evaluating and rewarding employee job performance. So those are the objectives. I think those are really important. I think that's what we set out to do when we took this task on. So these policies really go to that. If we adopt this pay structure and these policies, employees will know, and we'll know how it should work. I'm not going to go through all these, but I'll tell you the general categories. So the first one is, if we create a new job, how do we decide what grade it needs to be in? And CBIZ actually says, just call us and we'll help you figure it out based on what they're going to do, but this goes through how do you spot a new job, which is pretty basic. The next page talks about a requested review of job salary grade assignments. And what that is a supervisor or the employee themselves might say, hey, I don't feel like I'm in a grade 7. I think I should be in a grade 8. My duties have gotten more complicated, and I want you to review my job. So this talks about how we're going to do that. We're going to do it during the budget process. This is the type of information that will need to be presented. And here's how we're going to review whether your job should be regraded or not.
Where does this fall within the organization? Is it under Brenda or?
It's actually going to be under me with Melissa is going to be assisting me with this. I'm going to have Melissa do a lot of it, but I'll have approval.
Okay.
Of everything. So this talks about where we bring employees in initially, and like I said, it's really going to depend on the position, but generally we try to bring them in the lower end of the range so they can progress. But again, if we hire in somebody with a lot of experience, that will be different. Determining pay for promotions and demotions. We didn't have a policy before. The policies we got back from CBIZ were hard policies that says you shall give a 10% raise for a promotion or you shall give a 10% demotion. But I softened this up to say generally we may do that. But you know, we're a small organization. I'm not going to tie our hands to it has to be 10% because that can create compression issues or leapfrog issues or unintended consequences. So we have some flexibility here on promotions and demotions, but the point here is employees should understand if they get promoted, they should expect an increase, but if they get demoted either by their choice or our choice, they should expect a decrease. So that's in here as well. The market-based pay adjustments, that's basically what we were talking about before. When you've got hot positions such as accountants or investment professionals and the market's moving quickly, this talks about how we deal with that. This isn't based on the specific individual. It's more, hey, IT professionals, we can't find them. We need to increase that. This section talks about that. And then on an annual basis, we will adjust the salary structure. And the way we're going to do that is for 5 years, CBIZ will send us a letter and say, you know, based on your market, here's what you should do with your salary structure. Increase it 2%, and the whole structure will move. We'll use CBIZ while we have them as part of the initial fee that we paid or do our own analysis, but that's the plan. And then annually, we'll talk to CBIZ about what market pay increases and then talk to the board about what can we afford in the budget, and then depending on the budget, employees' performance and where they are within the range and other issues that will determine annual increases. And then because we are a small organization with a lot of issues that relate to how employees work to, you know, with compression and tenure and stuff like that, I added a line for executive director discretion. And that's also so employees know nothing's promised here. We have discretion to do always what's in the right, the best interest of the pension system. So that's what we have in the policy.
One thing I didn't see, and we've discussed, especially with Ryan's position, the temporary assignment pay.
Oh, that's a good point.
Should we codify that to the point where if you're riding up a one pay grade or two pay grades or whatever, that's considered temporary, whatever?
Yeah, I can put something in there on that.
I think for the promotions and demotions, you should put a range. Like something that's minimal, like if it's not going to be actionable if it's less than 3%. So 3% to 10%, because you can also send messaging to employees.
The way I have it written in here, and I know I didn't go over all the details,
but that 10% kind of still people will see that.
Mm-hmm. So you think that's too harsh, or I should lower that?
I think you put a range because in that range you can show significance of. Is it their really site that we're here, so there, or is it in between? I think the messaging in that is also, because you're nothing below 3% should be actionable, right? I don't know. Maybe you want, I don't know. But if you're going to demote someone or promote something, you can imagine there should be a minimal at least something that's going to cover that, you know, I don't know.
Right. And generally, we don't really do that. But I'm thinking more, the situation is more likely of where an employee says, hey, I don't want all this responsibility anymore. instead of being this, I want to be this. So.
Oh, wow.
The way,
something different.
Yes, and that's actually more likely.
But if they're in the range of the lower job, then you don't have to take any, the minimum, you don't have to take any action.
You don't, but then if I have other incumbents in that job that have been here longer and know it better, then that's why I want
you have the flexibility,
and not keep a shell or whatever. But I don't have a problem putting a range in.
Yeah, because I think that,
Okay, we want to go ahead and make a motion to adopt these compensation policies that Kelly's outlined, along with the whole methodology and path to...
Make a motion.
Well, do we want to Bill's point, to freeze it, though? We didn't want to freeze.
Yeah, that's what I would object to at this stage. Can we freeze anybody above them? Don't we know what they are?
Yeah.
They bring back a...
So with that alteration...
We need the changes that he said, you, Armando, put. Yeah.
I think it'd be good just to come back and let us know what you decide.
Okay.
How this works, plus or minus.
Okay.
What you can implement.
So do we want a motion, Josh, or
not? I think we should bring it back next month.
Okay.
Changes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is a much better one. This is well done. Now,
yeah.
Right now, this is the way to do it.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you.
All right. So we want to go into executive session now with the proper internal people.